By this stage, I was doing phantom race calls out of the newspaper. Had been for quite a while. And Mum said to Grandfather, "How would you like to hear John call a phantom race?" He said, "Love to." He handed me the Sunday paper. I called a race out of the paper from the fields pertaining to the following day's racing at Randwick, Easter Monday.
Outstanding.
Called the race. He was stunned and bowled over and quite excited by it. And when I'd finished, he said, "Have you ever been to the races?" I said, "No, but it is my dream." He said, "How would you like to go tomorrow?" I couldn't believe my ears.
Good, how good. Before microphones and TV cameras, before he became a household name, John Tapp was a young boy racing paddle pop sticks down a stormwater canal, calling every one of them home as if they were the real thing. That childhood spark turned into a career that would make him one of Australia's most loved sporting voices. Known affectionately as Tappy, John has caught over 50,000 races, spent 3 decades with Channel 9, and became the voice that defined generations of Aussie racing fans. Behind the fame is a story of grit, gratitude, and giving back, a story built on perseverance, purpose, and a passion for people. In this chat, John shares how he went from homemade phantom race calls into a saucepan to the pressure of calling his first Melbourne Cup. He talks about rejection, resilience, and what it took to find his unique style, plus the lessons he's carried from a lifetime in the public eye into his work for causes close to his heart. If you love sport, storytelling, and a good laugh from someone who's seen it all, this one's for you. It's heartfelt, full of character, and packed with timeless wisdom from one of Australia's greats. I'm Ian Hawkins, and this is Sport is Life. The purpose of sport, as I see it, is to see your vision become a reality. Find your voice, create strong connections, and learn to trust your body. So, John, how are you going?
Pretty good, Ian. Getting old, of course, but it beats the hell out of the alternative, and I'm slowly learning to accept it.
Nice. You're looking, still looking really well.
Well, thank you. Actually, you've caught me on my birthday.
Oh, outstanding. Happy
very
birthday.
Day. Yep. I'm turning 84 today.
Wow.
Feel How nothing good. Like it.
Well, you're a young fella, David, who hooked me up with this interview. He was telling me you're surprisingly busy for an 84-year-old.
I tried to retire 10 years ago.
Yeah.
I was still full-time then with Sky Racing.
Yeah,
doing a couple of weekly programs and enjoying it, but I just looked around one day and thought, it's time. I was 74 then. Some brilliant young people were coming through, and I wanted to see them flourish and develop and get a go in the industry. And I thought it's time for me to take some golf lessons and get to the cinema, get to the theatre. And start to enjoy life a little bit. I lasted 2.5 weeks, and I was very unsettled and very unhappy. And it was my daughter Rebecca who said, "Look, you're driving Mum crazy. The answer for you is a racing website." She organised it, got it up and running, and it's been going 7 years, Ian.
It's
far more work than I ever intended.
Yeah,
but better than the way I was heading, which was very, very unhappy and very unsettled.
Yeah, well, you need to keep that purpose, don't you? So you have your own podcast too on that website too, is that right?
Yes, we do. I get to talk to some fabulous and very interesting racing people. Jockeys, trainers, owners, breeders, you name it. And only yesterday we posted episode 550. I can't
Wow.
believe it. It's a lot of work, a lot of research, as you would well know.
Yep.
But I enjoy it, and it just keeps me across an industry that I love dearly and an
Yeah.
industry that has been my life since the mid-1960s.
Wow, incredible. The timing for this is in the lead up to the Melbourne Cup. And when I actually asked, well, I call him Tappy, I know that's probably you as well, but David, I asked him, I was thinking, oh, I wonder if John actually did a Melbourne Cup call. But when I read the story of how you actually did, that was pretty cool how that sort of unfolded as well. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, Ian, most commentators in Australia in my time have been able to call the Melbourne Cup every year because they happen to be with the right network. Now, Channel 10 have the exclusive rights to the Melbourne Cup coverage through all the years I was with Channel 9. So I knew I was never going to get to call a Melbourne Cup as long as 10 had the contract. But a funny thing happened in the mid-1970s. There was a little group of radio stations. I know 2SM in Sydney was one of them, who made an approach to the Macquarie Network for a separate independent call of the cup to be set up for them. And I got the job.
How good.
And I called the first two, 74, 75, to a little group of radio stations. I think there were three or four, no more than that. But the year after, 1976, again, I went off to Melbourne expecting to be calling the cup for the same little group of radio stations, and then all hell broke loose. Channel 9 in Sydney made an 11th-hour decision to cover the cup only, not every race on the program, just the Melbourne Cup, and that they would slot it into their afternoon programming and put it to air live. And I got a phone call in the secretary's office at Flemington Racecourse early in the day to tell me that my call for the cup would be going live on Channel 9.
Fantastic.
1 hour before that cup, the heavens opened. I've never seen rain like it. Any other race in the world would have been off.
Wow.
But because it was the Melbourne Cup, they elected to go ahead. When the storm passed and it disappeared in half an hour, there was 1 foot of water in the mounting enclosure. The horses were parading up to their knees in water. It was just the most eerie, bizarre sight from my broadcasting box. The race was run on a quagmire track, and it was won by a skinny, unimpressive-looking New Zealand horse called Vanderhun. I've never. The jockey's colours were almost unrecognisable. I don't think the jockey's mothers would have known them. And it was really a bit hit and miss, and every caller there that day nominated Vanderhun when he made his run and hoped they were right. And we were, thank God. But I've never forgotten it. I can still see that horse. He was a gawky, skinny, unimpressive looking animal with a very high galloping action. And he made a lonely and funny sight as he came down the outside all by himself to win the Cup of
Wow.
76.
Love the water, obviously. I'm curious. I actually got goosebumps through that whole story. Amazing. When your the vision's gone, is it just your instincts? Because you said all the callers got it right. Is it instincts taking over? Are you've done that much study that you understand the gait of the horse, the movements, the subtleties of the jockey, or is it just sort of trusting what your gut's telling you in those moments?
Yeah, there is some instinct, but in a 2 mile race, Ian, you've got plenty of time to establish the running order. You know who's in front. You know who's running fourth. You know who's running 10th. You know who's back at the tail of the field. So by the time they come around the turn, you've got a fairly good idea of the running order before they turn for home. It's difficult, of course, when you can't recognize the jockey's colors, but there are other little tricks of the trade too. Sometimes you'll see a white blaze or a white snip on a horse's face, and you make a mental note of that in the event of an emergency. Sometimes a horse's action is a help, and that's what happened to me with this horse, Van der Hum. He had a high climbing action, which I'd seen on television in previous weeks in these lead-up races. So the first thing I noticed about him was this action, where his knees almost hit him under the chin. And I based my recognition of Van der Hum on his action more than anything else. I got it right, and I was lucky.
Fantastic. And your one call that gets televised, thank goodness you got it right. Have you had any moments like big races where you've got it wrong?
Oh, well, yeah, not so much big races, thankfully,
Yeah.
but throughout my long career, and I'm more than happy to be totally honest about it, I called the wrong horse three or four times over a long period of years. For whatever the reason, it's a pure case of mistaken identity. You know, for whatever reason, you think horse A is horse B, and that's the way you start to call them when the barrier opens. And unless somebody digs you in the ribs to alert you that you're doing the wrong thing, you can't get off the bus until it stops. Now, you don't realize what's happened until the race is over. You look at the semaphore, the numbers go into the frame, you look at your race book, and in that horrible, lonely, dark moment, when you realize you've called the wrong one.
Sinking
There's nowhere to
feeling.
hide. No excuse is good enough. You've got to put your hand up, admit the blue, and get on to the next race and try and put it out of your mind. But it does tend to stick there forever. I still think about those three or four occasions.
Yeah, wow. Well, I read on your bio, 3 or 4 out of 50,000 races is pretty good odds, I reckon.
I guess it is, and thanks for that. But
Yeah.
it's four too many, mate.
Of
Four too
course,
many.
yeah. We're all human, even the greats are human, right? Imagine these days if you got it wrong. The punters would be on social media, like it'd be sweeping through everywhere.
Ian, if I'm grateful for one thing, looking back on 50 odd years in the business, it's the fact that I was not subjected to social media. I finished race calling towards the end of 1998. Social media was unknown. And thank God I wasn't subjected to the trauma and the stress that that thing can cause, because there have been race callers subsequently, friends of mine, colleagues of mine, who have been hammered by social media for the most basic mistakes. And I count my lucky stars that I didn't have to put up with it.
Yeah, unfortunately, people talking with their wallet can be quite aggressive, can't they? And social media is unfortunately giving them a platform.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, look, there are positives and negatives to social media. There are some wonderful aspects. There is no better source of instant news. We all realize that, and I commend the people who do all of the good things on social media. But I absolutely condemn those that use it for the wrong reasons and cause tremendous harm, hurt, and distress to people who don't deserve it.
Yeah, well said. There's no doubt some larger than life characters in the racing industry, Is there someone that sort of sticks out for you as someone that left a bit of a mark over all those years of Corley races?
Oh, well, there've been so many, and you wouldn't know where to start. But the one, I don't know that I should call him a character. I'm talking about a former race caller, a man who had an enormous impact on my career, on my life, really, was a man called Ken Howard, who, when I started in the 1960s, was the doyen of all Australian race callers and the benchmark by which every aspiring young caller, directed his future. Ken was in a pre-television era, radio only, and that enabled Ken to take a little bit of poetic license, you know.
Yeah, right.
Looking back now, his calls were not always as accurate as they could have been, but by God, they were entertaining. And to people listening on radio only, he could make the hair on the back of your neck stand up. I worked alongside him for 9 years with 2GB Radio as his understudy. He'd been my inspiration and my hero from age 10.
Wow.
So he had a colossal impact on my career and my life. Yeah. When he finally retired on New Year's Eve 1973, and I was poised to take over the role, by then I had developed my future plans, and I was well aware that I had to concentrate a little more on the accuracy factor than Ken had done, because he didn't have to, but I did, because television was starting. Live racing on television was in its infancy, destined to become nowadays, as you know, a fact of life. You can watch any race anywhere in Australia, thoroughbred, harness or greyhounds, at home, sitting in your lounge chair and betting on your telephone.
Yeah.
Amazing. And I could see that coming, obviously. And
yeah.
So accuracy had to become a dominant part of my makeup.
Yeah, I bet. Now, I read this story. It might have even been in your bio, I can't remember. As a young fella, you're painting paddle pop sticks in the horses' colours and then racing them down like drain pipes. Is that how it unfolded for you? Yeah,
that's absolutely 100% correct. They were paddle pop sticks. People today probably don't know paddle pops. They were simply icy pole sticks.
Yeah.
I think the brand is long gone, but they were very popular in the 1950s.
Yeah.
People tended to buy one at the shop on a hot day, demolish it, and then throw the stick on the ground. And the streets were littered with paddle pop, used paddle pop sticks. So I'd collect them, take them home. You know how people in their backyard sheds always had three or four tiny little tins of paint that they would buy for small jobs around the house, you know. There were some in my shed, but I would also acquire them from neighbours, and I finished up with every colour of the rainbow in these little tins. So I would paint the paddle pop sticks in the colours pertaining to the well-known horses of this era, and it was a golden era in Australian racing. I would then throw them into a stormwater channel which flowed nearby to my home in Cogra, and I'd walk for miles calling them as though they were real racehorses. That's how it started.
Wow.
I was 10 years old, and it seems like yesterday.
Yeah, I bet. You paint such a great picture there. I think I've heard a similar story, Ray Warren talking about doing race calls with marbles or something.
Correct.
I love with these stories how, like, you can maybe not born to be a race caller, but how, like, this passion has come from such a young age. To me, it just demonstrates why you became so good. Like you talked about Ken Howard being the doyen, I think that's probably a word that's associated with you in many ways, particularly in New South Wales, for Yeah, and those Wide World of Sports days when you were the face of racing in Sydney.
Yes, and I was involved with Channel 9 for many, many years, Ian, well over 30 years, in fact.
Yeah,
And
wow.
I look back on those days with delight and gratitude. Matter of fact, I'm having dinner this week, 24 hours from now, with Ian Chappell,
Oh, wow.
who is a regular on that show, Wide World of Sports. I
Yeah.
saw a lot of him around the channel in those days. He wasn't particularly interested in racing. I wasn't a cricket fanatic, although I did have a casual interest, but we became good friends because of the show. The show we were all part of. And he called me recently, haven't seen him for 10 years,
Yeah,
and
wow.
we're having dinner tomorrow night, and I'm really looking forward to it. And I'm sure the main topic of conversation won't be horse racing and it won't be cricket. It will be the good old days of Wide World of Sports, and I'm sure we'll be paying homage to our late departed and very dear mate, Mike Gibson, who passed on a few years ago.
Yeah, and like for people in my era, Gibbo was just iconic because it was like your Saturday afternoons, your Sunday afternoons as well, Sports Sunday there. Yeah, he was the face of Channel 9 Sport, and him and Ciappelli doing that for so many years. Oh, great memories as a kid.
Yeah, good to hear, Ian. Good
Yeah.
to hear. I'm glad I played a small part in providing those memories for you.
Yeah, and immortalised by Billy Birmingham, the 12th man too. You all got a start on that. I think that really added to the stature of the whole thing.
What a talent. What a talent, eh? Billy Birmingham. The accuracy of his impersonations was quite stunning. You know, when it was all up and running and getting huge airplay, Billy put on a special night at the old Mossman Rowing Club,
Yeah.
Mossman Rowers, and he presented each of us with a platinum disc mounted in a frame, beautiful thing, and he called each of us to the microphone one by one and presented us with our platinum disc in our own voices. In
How
other words,
good.
he did what he did on the recording live as he presented each of us with our platinum disc. It was a magic night. I've never forgotten it. And that the talent and the skill of that man was mind-boggling.
Oh, absolutely. And just the voice of a generation, as much as any of you guys who are on the Whitewater Sports or in the cricket commentary team. Like, it just goes hand in hand. Yeah, you're right. What a talent. How do you go from being that young 10-year-old with that passion for calling races? Like, do you have a moment where you're actually at the races for the first time? Was that before when you were calling? Had you already been? Like, how does the sort of next sort of 10 years unfold that takes you to working in that industry?
It unfolded in the most unexpected and delightful way.
Yeah.
My mum and dad separated when I was very young, and my brother and I lost contact completely with our dad's parents, our grandparents. We hadn't
Yeah.
seen them for years. Now, I'd known all along that grandfather was a punter and a very keen racing man, but I'd never been able to explore that with him because of circumstances. One Sunday afternoon, my mum said, "Do you want to go and see grandmother and grandfather at San Susi?" And my brother and I said, "We'd love to."
Yeah.
We got on a trolley bus at Cogra Station. We went to their home at San Susi, excuse me, Ian. Knocked on the front door, unannounced, and Grandma opened the door and she was surprised and excited. Got a shock, in fact, and
Yeah.
Grandfather came out. We went inside. Now, by this stage, I was doing phantom race calls out of the newspaper. Had been for quite a while. And Mum said to Grandfather, "How would you like to hear John call a phantom race?" He said, love to. He handed me the Sunday paper.
Yeah.
I called a race out of the paper from the fields pertaining to the following day's racing at Randwick, Easter Monday.
Outstanding.
Called the race. He was stunned and bowled over and quite excited by it. And when I'd finished, he said, have you ever been to the races? I said, no, but it is my dream. He said, how would you like to go tomorrow? I couldn't believe my
How
ears.
good, how good.
I was 14 by this, 14 years old. I'd never been because nobody would take me. He said, you meet me at Kogarah Railway Station at 10 o'clock in the morning, and we'll go to Randwick and we'll watch the Sydney Cup. Was the big race on the day. I met him at 10. I think I was there at 9:30. He came over the other side of the station in the trolley bus, and I can still see that little man. He was a Welshman walking up the stairs in a three-piece grey suit with the mandatory hat that every bloke wore in that era. He had a brown paper bag tucked under his arm and a newspaper under the other, with all of his form guides and what have you. We caught the train to Eddy Avenue at Central, where we got a racecourse tram, and Randwick then had its own tram siding. And I can remember the excitement
I
going
bet.
through the turnstile. There was a bloke selling race books and pencils at a little stand just inside the turnstile, and then we made our way over to the front of the grandstand opposite the winning post. And that's where I spent the day with grandfather.
Amazing.
The Sydney Cup, Ian, was won by a horse called Talisman. He was no champion. In fact, I don't know that he ever won another race, but he won that Sydney Cup. I had a favorite jockey at that time by the name of Stan Cassidy. Blow me down if he didn't ride Talisman. He won the Sydney Cup on my first day at the races. A talisman, as you know, is a lucky charm
Yeah.
or mascot, and I look back on that as an omen. What a lucky charm it was for me.
Fantastic. That is such a great story. I think anyone who can remember the first time they went to a sporting event as a kid, they can relate to that story. Like I can remember, we used to go to Parramatta Park to ride push bikes around there. And I could always see the footy going on Cumberland Oval, like, and I'd always be trying to get as close as I could to see through it. I always just wanted to go, and it wasn't until, same thing about those sort of mid-teens where I got taken, and I just remember the players getting off the bus and just looking up, like, wide-eyed, and yeah, those experiences just connect us to the sport straight away, don't they?
Oh, absolutely. And you're talking Richie Beno country now, of course. Parramatta.
Yeah.
Another wide world of sports icon who became a great mate later. And one of my greatest thrills was to have Richie on my little racing program on Sky Channel many years later.
Yeah.
He came over on Sunday morning because he loved the races and he appreciated good racehorses. And our conversation obviously was made up of two components, racing and cricket. And that was one of the happiest memories that I came away with, an interview with the great Richie Beno.
Outstanding. And I imagine for a lot of these guys, it's a bit of a thrill for them as well. Like, I'm sure that'd go both ways. Like, I think to anyone who grew up in that time, they'd see you as just as iconic as any of those guys, particularly for those of us living in New South Wales. So, like I said, when we first connected over the phone, it's a massive honour for me. I'm actually like a little bit sort of bit of a pinch me moment that we're doing this chat, but again, I appreciate it. You mentioned there, I can't remember his first name, but you said Cassidy. Was that a relation of Jim?
No,
No?
relation. Jim and Larry Cassidy, both retired now, by the way, after stellar writing careers are New Zealand born.
All
They
right.
came to Australia from New Zealand 30 years or more back. Stan Cassidy was an Aussie born and reared on a little farm at Burrewa in southern New South Wales. He became an apprentice jockey in the 1940s, went on to become a very successful jockey in Sydney. But I don't know why I cottoned onto him as my favourite rider, but I did for whatever reason. Maybe the fact that Hopalong Cassidy was one of my cinema idols at the time. I don't really know why that
Yeah.
happened. But he became, later on, would you believe, when I wanted to try and organise an entry into the radio industry, it was Stan Cassidy who organised an audition for me with a man called Cliff Carey, who was then the sporting editor of the 2GB Macquarie Network, who had 40 radio stations taking the racing on a Saturday afternoon around Australia. But it was Stan Cassidy who rode the Sydney Cup winner on my first day at the races, and he later gave me a hand to get into the radio game. No wonder he was became a great mate.
Yeah, full circle moment. So at that point, were you doing any calling anywhere?
Any calling?
Like any race calling? So before you got that job, like how do you get to that point that he's actually vouching for you?
Was getting into the races with a tape recorder, yes.
Yeah.
I remember writing a letter to the Sydney Turf Club asking permission to use an old vacant broadcasting box that I'd spotted in the public stand at Rose Hill. They wrote back, they said, yes, you can use that box, no problem. I set up shop there in about 1964 or 5 with a tape recorder, a pair of binoculars, a borrowed pair of binoculars because they were a pretty expensive item that I
Yeah.
couldn't afford. And I started to practice race calling onto that tape recorder. But it's like anything, Ian, you can only teach yourself so much before you need professional guidance. And I sort of hit a brick wall. That's when I finally made an appointment to go and see this man, Cliff Carey, who listened to the tapes. I can still see him sitting there behind his desk in Phillip Street. In those days, he was a smoker. He had a habit of letting the ash grow to a precarious length, and it would break off and spill all over his typewriter. It seems like yesterday, but he gave me my first job eventually as Ken Howard's understudy. And I spent 9 years in that role up until Ken's retirement, when I took over. And I was still going 60 years later, or 50 years later, behind the binoculars, and I'm still going, doing other things pertaining to horse racing.
So good. And I love, again, your hero, your race calling hero. You get to work with him, your jockey hero. Like you end up forming a friendship with him. So good. I think it says a lot for having a passion for something and really following that passion. I'm imagining someone when I'm growing up, if they had that skill, we would have been winding them up to do race calls all the time. Is that like, were you having
Oh yeah.
your friends?
Oh yeah, that happened all right. I don't know how many phantom calls I did into a saucepan. I found the saucepan created a sort of a reverb that sounded like a public address system. And I could, Melbourne Cup time, every year in the school playground, a group of mates would get me to do a phantom call in the playground at lunchtime. And that happened for
Excellent.
quite a few years. Yeah, and at parties, obviously, into the saucepan.
Yeah, fantastic. Can you remember that very first call that you did?
Audition call. I did an
Oh, in
audition
what?
call.
Yeah.
Yeah. Before I got the job, Cliff Carey sent me out to Canterbury Races on a Wednesday afternoon I can remember the exact date,
Yeah.
16th of December 1964. Ken Howard was there working, and I had to do one call to be pre-organized between Ken and myself, and Cliff would be listening back at the studio in Phillip Street, and my whole future hinged on this call. Can you imagine how the nerves were?
Yeah, I bet.
I was absolutely terrified. It was
Yeah.
decided that I would do race seven. Ken Howard stood beside me. He let me put my binoculars onto the tripod, but he used his own binoculars to double check what I was saying,
Yeah.
double check my call and its accuracy or lack thereof. So here I am. The call will decide my future.
As if
Standing
you
on
need,
my lips.
as if you need any more nerves, and you've got your childhood hero
Ah.
standing next to
It was just awful. It was just
Yeah.
awful. And the call was very, very plain.
Oh, really?
And Cliff used, I got on the phone immediately after in the box, and he used the words that have been immortalized in Hollywood folklore. Don't ring us, we'll ring you.
No.
That's what he said. Anyway, in the months that followed, I drove him absolutely crackers. I'd ring up every couple of weeks. Anything doing, Mr. Carey? Any further thoughts about my possible, appointment as an offsider to Ken Howard? And the months dragged on, nothing happened, and I was just about ready to give up. And one day, a telegram arrived. Young people watching now, Ian, wouldn't know what a telegram is.
No, they
It's
wouldn't.
a hand-delivered email, I guess you could say. The
Yeah.
telegram boy would knock on the door, you'd open the door, you'd see the GPO, it was called in those days. He'd be wearing the uniform and he'd hand you an envelope containing a telegram. I nervously opened it up, threw the envelope to one side, and read the words that I will never forget. Ken Howard is ill. Are you in a position to call the Wyong races for 2GB on Thursday? Please
Yes.
ring me, Cliff. I ran to the local phone box. I didn't have a telephone on at the time, couldn't afford it.
Yeah.
There was a woman in the phone box talking to her sister in a rather loud voice. I gleaned this listening, eavesdropping. And the minutes wore on, and I was jittery and nervous and apprehensive. I finished up banging on the door of the box, told her I had to ring the doctor urgently. Mum was sick. Anyway, she hung up the phone, terminated her conversation with her sister, let me in. I rang Cliff, and he said, come and see me. Can you come straight into the studio and talk to me? And I was on a train within half an hour.
Oh, I bet you were.
Yeah, went to Wyong a couple of days later, called the race meeting, and it was only weeks later, Ian, that he called me again and told me that I had a full-time job with the radio station as Ken Howard's understudy.
Wow,
They were
how good.
magical words.
Oh, I bet
Magical.
they were.
Yeah.
It's a great lesson in perseverance, and don't take no for an answer.
That's what it was. Sheer perseverance, unbridled perseverance, arrogant perseverance, and as far as Cliff was concerned, very irritating perseverance. In fact, he did say late years later that he gave me a job to get me off his back.
Well played. That's so
Yeah.
good. Oh, I love it. Do you have a
a moment in your calling where you just felt like everything fell into place and it was like, I don't know if it was necessarily seen as iconic by the rest of the world, but that you really remember as just being one of those great days, whether it was a big event or just something that really stuck in the memory?
Look, when I started, I really only knew the basics. I was still green, still feeling my way, and I was aware there was still so much to learn. I knew that a style had to develop and mould itself. I knew that I didn't want to sound too much like Ken Howard, who had influenced me greatly. And I think back then I did sound a lot like Ken Howard. I had to work on my own style. I had to learn to understand the mechanics of horse racing, learn about thoroughbred horses, understand the entire concept of what this business was all about. That doesn't happen overnight. And I think it was probably 5 years before I started to feel I had it all together. And that point on, it was just a matter of honing my craft, I guess.
Yeah. So it's not necessarily a moment, like a call that's well known, that what are we talking? Sydney, Golden Slipper, what else, what were the big events?
I guess so, because I was doing the trotting at Harold Park as well, as well as the gallops. Trotting had certainly become one of my great loves. I was at Harold Park every Friday night for the Macquarie Network, and one of the first big races and biggest performances that I've ever seen came along in the 1971 Miracle Mile, a very famous harness race introduced by the New South Wales Trotting Club in the 1960s. But this was the 1971 edition, and there was a Western Australian horse in that race by the name of Mount Eden, who missed the start hopelessly. He galloped in the score up behind the mobile barrier, and he gave top opposition 50 metres start, or 50 yards back then. Yeah. It was a physical impossibility for him to win.
Yep.
He caught them with a lap to go. He went around them, and he beat them by a big margin.
Wow.
Mount Eden in the 1971 Miracle Mile. I've said this before, and I'll say it again. It was the greatest performance I ever saw by a horse on an Australian racing track, a horse of either breed, thoroughbred or standard bred. He did the impossible that night. Uncanny. I saw a replay of it on YouTube only recently, and it gave me tingles up the spine to see it all over again. As far as thoroughbreds were concerned, there were so many wonderful horses and wonderful races, Ian, but the horse I remember best of all, the horse that motivated me as a caller, the horse who gave me more thrills and more satisfaction than any other, was Kingston Town, who won 30 races all up in a great career, 19 of them in Sydney, and I got to call every one of those 19 wins. Couldn't get to the races quickly enough when he was racing. Why did I like him so much? He was a beautiful black horse with a coat like satin. He had the sweetest galloping action. You could have sat a glass of water on his rump when he was in full flight, and he wouldn't have spilled a drop. He was so beautifully balanced. And when he was in full flight, it was a magical experience to watch him, to call him, and to try and communicate to our listeners what was happening before my very eyes. I loved him dearly. I think of him often.
Yeah.
There may have been better horses. Winks may have been better than Kingston Town. But he'll be my favourite forever and always.
Love it. Goosebumps all through that as well. And not the first time I've heard Kingston Town described that way. And just there was something about the horse. Obviously, it was striking features. But yeah, like, you know, they talk about those great horses as almost having knowledge beyond what they should. I remember listening to jockey whose name escapes me, of Winks, talk about how there was absolutely no doubt that it knew the sense of occasion. And was it the record breaking run when it got itself like 10 lengths behind? And you just said, come on, we got to go. And it kind of just like, you know, did what it needed to do. And Wynn probably wasn't feeling the best and reckoned the horse actually knew that it needed to parade past and was taking it all in just as much as he was.
Yeah. The jockey to whom you refer would be Hugh Bowman, who rode Winks almost exclusively. In fact, he did ride her exclusively in her 33-win streak, which was a world record and will probably remain so.
Yeah.
She knew where she was. She knew what she was doing. She knew where the winning post was. She knew what it was all about.
Yeah. This sort of horse is like, so I'm a part-time race fan at best, and just one of those horses that capture the attention of the general public, and Kingston Town was the same.
Yes, he was. He'll be my favourite as long as I'm walking the planet. I just love him. He ticked every box. Just a beautiful animal.
And the love go that deeply that even in retirement you go visit? Visit him?
My love for Kingston Town?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I've seen many other champion horses. I called many other champion horses, but there was just something about him, Ian, that stood him alone. He was different.
Yeah.
It was an upsetting moment in one way. I was out at Tommy Smith's stables one day at Randwick doing something for Channel 9 with a news camera, and Kingston Town was there, and the stable foreman was the late Tom Barker. And I said, can I give him a pat, Tom, while I'm here? Yeah. He said, well, yes. He said, but you be careful. I said, what do you mean? He said, he bites. I said, you're kidding. He said, no, he bites and he means business.
Wow.
He said, now you be very, very careful. There he is over there in box number 14. There he is, see his head sticking out. You go over and give him a pat, but you watch him. If he shows any sign of resentment of your presence, get the hell out of the way. He wasn't happy. He let me give him a quick little pat, but he would have preferred that I didn't. And that was a bit of a disillusionment, Ian, I got to tell you. I thought he was perfect in every way, but he wasn't.
Well, some of the best in any field can sometimes be a bit temperamental, so that's not that surprising. Yeah, yeah. That's what makes them so good. Now, am I right that your love of trotting even went to the extent that you did some training as well?
Oh yeah, I always wanted to do it. Yeah. You know, from the moment I first drove a pacer and experienced this unique sense of speed and rhythm, and the difference in driving one to riding one is the fact that you're so low to the ground. They seem to be going faster. Yeah, you can hear the fence posts whooshing by. And as I gained in confidence, I started to get myself to trotting stables on days off and drive as many of them as I could in track work. I just got keener and keener and keener. A few years later, I was driving my own horses in races at tracks like Harold Park in Sydney. Among my greatest thrills in life are the memories of driving winners on that iconic harness track, long gone now, taken over by developers in 2010. But the first win I recorded as a driver and a trainer at the Harold Park Paceway was one of the most exhilarating and satisfying experiences of my entire life.
It must have been surreal, like you go from someone who's been calling these horses for so long to be on the other side. And did that, do you feel like that gave you a new appreciation when you were calling, having gone into that realm?
Yes, I was made aware of it one night at Bankstown Trots when I was beaten on a short price favourite. And it wasn't my best drive. I pulled the wrong rein at a crucial stage of the race. I ran second. The horse was favourite. And there was a very rowdy, boisterous punter hanging over the fence as I came through the gap off the track, rather embarrassingly, head down, trying very hard to get back to the stalls and out of sight. And this bloke gave me a monumental gobful.
Yeah.
He reminded me that I should stick to race calling, forget about driving harness horses, and that I should be ashamed of the performance that I offered that night to the punters at Bankstown. He didn't miss me, and you know what? He was right, and he was fully entitled to do it.
Fair. That's a great story. Tell me, 50,000 race calls, what were some of the strategies and processes you used to make sure you stayed at the top of your game?
I tried not to worry about the memory factor and learning all of those colours until certainly the day of the race, and preferably as each race came along. The memory bank is a funny thing, Ian. It reaches a saturation point.
Yeah.
It's tired and it shuts down. And I learned that it's far better to concentrate on each race, each assignment as it comes along. Now, that concentration requires total quiet and no distractions whatsoever. Yeah. So I would close the door of the broadcast box from the moment the jockeys appeared on the lawn. They'd all come out of the jockeys' room. They'd stand below me on the lawn in the mounting yard, talking to owners and trainers pre-race.
Yep.
And I had a few precious minutes to try and get those colours into my memory bank.
Yeah, right. Wow.
And then all the way around to the barrier, you'd be with the binoculars going through them backwards and forwards out loud. I preferred to utter the name of the horse out loud. I think it helped to keep it in there.
Yeah.
So that by the time those horses moved into the barrier and were ready to jump, they were locked in. Now, there was always the morbid fear that one of them might escape from that memory bank during the race. And that could happen.
Yeah.
Little block. And the secret then is don't panic. You must stay calm.
Yeah.
Just keep an eye, keep going back through the field. Just keep one eye on the horse that's got you worried. It'll come back to you, but don't panic. You've got to stay calm. And, you know, I had a few hairy moments. In many races over many years, you can usually work your way through those little problems if you stay calm. If you panic, all's lost.
Yeah, so true. And what you're describing is that much like this situation for me is like when I've thought of an idea and then it goes, I do a lot of writing, I've got a lot of notes scribbled here as well as we go. But if I had something that I really wanted to talk about, I used to get all panicky and then it would go forever, whereas now, stay calm and I breathe and I know it'll just pop back into my head. I think that's the subconscious mind will help us if we, as you say, stay calm. Great advice.
Yeah, it pops back as long as you've got control of yourself.
Yeah.
So
spot
important.
On.
So and you know, this applies to singers, to actors, you know, anybody who's relying on memory and concentration, that little mental block can happen. Do you know one of the greatest actors in the history of the cinema and of the stage was the iconic Sir Laurence Olivier?
Yeah.
I mean, they don't come any more talented or any more famous than Laurence Olivier. Yeah. He went through a little patch in his great career way back when he started to develop stage fright.
What?
Sounds ridiculous, but it happened to him. And on several occasions over several weeks, he'd forget his lines. And he'd be gripped by fear. Now, actors, as you know, have a prompter just off stage who's waiting for this to happen, and they can yell the words out and the actor can get out of trouble. But it happened to Laurence Olivier.
Yeah, if it can happen to him, it can happen to anyone.
You've got to stay calm.
You've got to stay calm. So good. You've dedicated a lot of your time and energy into contribution and helping a number of charities. Was there something that you inspired you to start giving back like that?
Two things happened. I always felt very conscious of the fact that I should be doing something to help those who needed some help. Yep. And there are so many wonderful charities out there, it's hard to know where to start. Yeah. I also had a wife, Anne, who very forcibly insisted that I do something along these lines. Use the media channels that were available to me to organise interest in certain projects for charity, to use connections for auction items, raffle items, you know, all of the things you need to raise money at these very important charity events. Anne did a hell of a lot of the groundwork, and then on the nights, whatever it might be, my job was to get up there, present it, tell people what it was all about, and encourage them to hit the kick, as we say. Spend a dollar or two on auction items or raffle items and help charities along. Variety Club was one of our most important. We spent a lot of time at functions to help the underprivileged children of this country. Diabetes Australia was another one that we put a fair bit of work into, but there were many others. The Bear Cottage, many smaller ones, all enjoyable, hard work at the time, Ian, but gratifying and rewarding, and something I look back on with you know, comfort.
Yeah.
And satisfaction.
Yeah, absolutely. And that there's so much fulfillment that comes from, like, from your position of the privileged position to be able to have those connections and be able to help. I think that's great. It just goes to show what we talked about before with the calling. We had some technical difficulties halfway through, and we were talking about the importance of having a good team around us to be able to get us out of trouble. And I think it's the same, like you talked about your wife putting you, like, suggesting you do that. Like, we need great teammates, great partners to get us to where we want to go, right?
Yeah, it was wonderful. Looking back now, actually, Harold Park was one of our favourite venues on a trot night, on a race night.
Yeah.
Where people, we could run all of our little auctions and raffles and what have you between races. And then as the race came on, people would go out onto the viewing balcony with a beer, watch the race, enjoy the spectacle, and then we'd come back into the room and raise some more money. Harold Park was a fabulous venue for fundraising. Peter Verlandes, by the way, was at that time CEO of the New South Wales Harness Racing Club, and he gave us an enormous amount of help in organising those functions. He would give us meals at the right price, drinks at the right price. The club would make donations to the charity. Peter Verlandes is another man who's also done a lot for charity behind the scenes.
Yeah, it's fantastic. I love it. Your wife must have been a huge support, like, obviously knew that it was important for you to get back out there, like your daughter identified you sending your wife crazy. She must have been an incredible woman to have been able to support you through all of that, and yeah, I imagine almost wouldn't have been able to do it without her, yeah?
Oh, how true. Anne is my second wife, Ian, but having said that, I can tell you we've been married for 46 years. She worked in radio and television herself for a number of years in the sales area. She was a 2GB, she was a Channel 9 for quite a while, so she had a terrific understanding of the machinations of this business, which enabled her to give me help that otherwise may not have happened. She's been a tremendous support, always there when I needed some support and guidance and wise counsel, and that still applies to this day.
Love it. Now, I couldn't let you leave without giving our listeners, because this will go out to on air before the Cup, have you got a tip for us, John, for the Melbourne Cup?
Ian, the Cup is, as from the moment we are now embracing, the Melbourne Cup is still several weeks away, the first Tuesday in November.
Yeah.
Now, things that can go wrong between now and Cup Day are countless. You've got the weather factor. You've got, you know, the well-being of many horses. It would be suicidal to endeavour to pick the Melbourne Cup winner this far out. I should also inform you respectfully that I haven't tipped the Melbourne Cup winner since 1956.
Well, you're due. I remember. I can't remember which one of them. It might have even been Jim Cassidy. It was one of those older jockeys, and they were asked to get the year that the two Japanese horses came, one, two, and he tipped that a couple of weeks out. Well, it was as good a reason as any. So I got on that through a couple of others and managed to get the trifecta that year based on his tip. So I just thought maybe you might have some sort of inside knowledge, but yeah, it's a long way out. So.
You sure it was the year the Japanese horses fought out the finish?
Yeah, that's right.
That's the year you're talking about.
Yeah.
That was Delta Blues and Pop Rock.
There you go. It's all in your memory. I love it. And was it Honor Jeune third, maybe?
I think so. Yeah. Honor Jeune was placed in the Melbourne Cup, and that may have been the year. Well done. Mm. Well done.
Well, it bought me a few hot dinners, that one. So, yeah. It's a good one. Because from memory, those, like, one of them was pretty long odds too. So, yeah, that was good. I won't push you on that. Maybe I'll, maybe that's something we can talk about later on. You must have some contacts. Anyway, John, mate, massive honour. Thank you so much for coming on. I've loved these stories. It's a bit of a trip down memory lane as well. I really appreciate you giving me this time, and for the listeners as well, fantastic story.
Well, Ian, the honour and the pleasure has been all mine. When you get to my stage, of life, and this stage of my professional life, it's nice to be remembered.
Oh, that's great. I can imagine. Like I said, anyone growing up in my generation, you're not going to be someone forgotten anytime soon. So again, I appreciate it, and I thank you for those kind words too. Cheers, John.
Great pleasure, Ian. Thank you.
There's something timeless about Tappy's story, isn't there? And not just because of the races he's called, but the lessons he's lived. His journey reminds us that passion doesn't come from luck, it comes from persistence. That mastery isn't built overnight, it's earned one small step, one brave moment, one call at a time. Whether it's chasing your own dream, backing yourself through rejection, or finding purpose beyond success, John's story shows what's possible when you keep showing up and doing the work. If this episode sparked something in you or reminded you of why you do what you do, share it with someone who needs that same lift today. And if you're ready to take the next step in your own game plan to find your voice, your purpose, and your next level, click the link in the show notes. Let's connect. You've taken the time to listen to this whole episode. Now it's time to take action. Commit to one thing you've learned today and make it happen. And to avoid any obstructions, join the Sport is Life movement by clicking on the link in the show notes.